Welcome to Academics of PA. My name is Bruce McDonald, and of course, this week we have with us David Swindell from Arizona State University.
Pleasure to be with you.
So one of the reasons that we wanted to have you on is to kind of talk about the applied side of public administration. You know, if you look back enough at the history of PA, we kind of do start off really as an applied field, you know, talking about how to improve the work and function of government. But a lot of the work that takes place within the field now is much more theoretically oriented and has kind of gotten away from a little bit of that applied history. So I guess kind of trying to think of a good way to kind of start the conversation, kind of how you got into the field and what is it about the applied side that keeps you interested? And I guess at the same time, what applied type of work do you really do?
That's a very polite way of saying that. I think that the field may have gone further astray than you might be suggesting in terms of the applied side. I've been very fortunate with my career. I was working in Texas as an undergraduate in philosophy. I was working with a lot of political campaigns, and my mentors were all lawyers. I wanted to be the guy whispering in the ear of the elected official about policy prescriptions and recommendations, and so I wanted to study public policy. And all my mentors, all these lawyers, told me, you got to go to law school. So I started in the law school path and realized there's got to be a better way to do this. Ended up going into a PhD program at Indiana University and fell in with a group of scholars that were phenomenally influential on me, including Eleanor Ostrom, Roger Parks, and others that really integrated both the theory and the practice so well. The idea of reaching out and engaging with citizens. I literally ended up writing my dissertation on community engagement because, not because I had any interest in that going into the PhD program, but because my advisor, Roger Parks, asked me to cover a meeting for him up in Indianapolis one evening that he couldn't make. So I had to go up there and take notes for him, and I was hooked. And so it ended up leading to a dissertation, but it was working. It led me to an opportunity to work in the mayor's office. It led me to an opportunity to work in these communities with people who, quite frankly, did not look like me, did not have the same kind of opportunities that I did. It opened up a whole panoply of options for me to do the kind of work that I've continued to do today. And so, you know, if you advance the clock, I'm now directing a center dedicated to working with local governments, working with students who are this passion for public service that I want to do everything I can to stoke as much as possible. And the best way that I've discovered how to do that is to really help them bring what they're learning in the MPA curriculum and the MPP curriculum to applied projects as they do their capstones. It's one of the ways that we've been able to do applied work for some local governments around the country, as well as really allow the students to weave together the curriculum that they've been exposed to into why that material matters for solving problems for communities that have a real impact on people's lives. And the projects that they've done have, you know, been implemented by local governments, and we've had projects that have been written about in USA Today for nonprofit organizations that we've worked for. It's a fantastic experience to be able to work with students on that applied side. And that's where a lot of my work is just the culmination of the training that I had back at Indiana University with those scholars who were truly dedicated to this idea of tying theory to practice.
What kind of applied products do they actually work on?
Well, right now, the capstone class that I'm teaching right now, we have projects that are very diverse. One of them is looking at lead paint abatement in a Michigan city, and we have a project in Pennsylvania that's looking at organizational redesign of the local government structure. We have another one that's here in Arizona that's looking at recycling. One that's working on a redesign of the elected officials training for our League of Cities here in Arizona. So there's a wide array of these projects. I simply, you know, shake the tree of my network to solicit project ideas for communities, particularly smaller communities. That's what I'm really interested in working with, are those smaller communities that don't have deep reservoirs of resources to do some of these projects that they need help on, we can do that. It's a great opportunity for the students to learn some of the challenges of doing applied work. The data are always dirty. How do we deal with that? Once some projects can't be done, you have to pivot. How do we go through that process? But it's also really useful for those communities to get that work back in a way that they can act on it. And they, many of them have, whether we've rewritten zoning codes based on comparable studies of similar communities, just any number of projects like that. And that's all separate from the work that the Center for Urban Innovation does, which also has a very applied focus with regards to working with cities around the country, both in the U.S. and Canada. So it's I've been very fortunate to find myself in a position to get to do a lot of this applied work while at the same time keeping my foot in the academic side and dealing with theory and methodological issues that I really enjoy as well.
Okay, I'm absolutely flabbergasted. So when I was in South Bend, I ran the capstone for a couple semesters, and we did apply products for the community, and it was great. It was one of the most stressful things I've ever done as a teacher because of managing the students, making sure the communities get something out of it, and then finding communities who actually were willing to engage students, and yet you actually have people from multiple states who are willing to do that with you.
We have here at ASU and with the Center for Urban Innovation, we have a partnership with a nonprofit organization known as the Alliance for Innovation. And that's a primary vehicle through which I reach out to communities. So they have about 200-250 or so local government jurisdictions that, as I say, drink the Kool-Aid about innovation. So they're willing to try new things. They're a very proactive, very student-supportive array of local governments around the country and across North America. So they have been providing a lot of really good project ideas for our students. And we've done things in Fort Collins and San Pablo, California, and like I said, in State College, Pennsylvania, and Grand Rapids, Michigan, just all over the country, which is fantastic to be able to do from Phoenix, as well as a lot of projects here in Phoenix as well. But that network is really helpful. Plus, we have a partnership with the International City County Management Association, which has facilitated not just a network. We have to be very careful about using that network because there's so many members that right. We're much more selective about how we reach out to members of ICMA because we can get flooded with them. We get far more project ideas than we have the capacity with our students to use. And I share those with other colleagues of the schools and both here at ASU, but also other schools at other universities, because we just have so many of those project ideas. And not all the professors are really comfortable doing it the way that I do. I run it basically like sort of like a consulting firm. We have these teams of consultants that are doing these projects for these communities. But that's not an experience set that all professors have. It does take some willingness to engage the community that I think is not something that we're trained too well in usually as professors, but it is something that I think is very core to the ASU charter with regards to the embeddedness of our programs in community. And this kind of outreach, working with local governments and nonprofit organizations, is very much the DNA of this university, which makes me feel really good about the work that we do. But it also provides the students just some amazing opportunities and access to decision makers who just crave the help and the information that we can help provide them in this learning experience for the students.
Yeah, I mean, if you think about the number of cities around the U.S. and the number of counties, there are definitely a lot that are growing. But there's a lot that are shrinking, and the ones who are shrinking are the ones who need help. And most of the time, they don't have really anybody to turn to.
One of the sadder, I guess, projects that we've worked on has been with one of our regional communities that is facing a significant challenge. They are simply not going to be able to make their budget within the next 5 years, and they are going to have to face the potential for disincorporation, which is not the outcome that a lot of cities want. And there's not a whole lot of reason to expect that any of the surrounding communities are going to want to annex them due to some of the challenges that that particular area faces. It's a small area, which is part of the challenge, but that is an area where we've worked because they need that help. They absolutely, as they've continued to trim back their staff, they are really facing some very basic service delivery challenges that we have tried to help with in various ways on some issues with regards to homelessness living in cars and the rules about removing those cars when there's no there is no shelter available in that community to house them. So what do you, I mean, how do you take care of that challenged population? To something as simple as updating their zoning codes because they're pretty out of date. Basic right. things like that that the smaller communities, and particularly the ones that are in retrenchment mode, are facing. That is that's one of the areas where I think we can do some really good work because they are in such need. We can provide that some help to ease the transition if, in fact, that's the path that they're on.
I'm thinking about Benson here in North Carolina. If anybody from Benson's listening, my apologies, but probably not. they have seen a massive decline in their population in recent years. You know, 90-something percent of cities and counties in North Carolina are shrinking. There's only really a few that are really actually doing much growth. And their solution was, well, they had seen where other cities had started microbreweries. So they were going to try and start a microbrewery that was going to solve all their problems. And thankfully, they didn't. You know, we went through a nice long process with them to figure out what they needed to do, where they should be going, what they should be trying to accomplish. And they were flabbergasted that faculty from anywhere would be willing to sit there and talk with them.
Yeah. Yeah, it's amazing that there's this disconnect. And that's this project that you and I have discussed previously about that we're doing with practitioners out in the communities to find ways of engaging more practitioners in our classrooms. Mm-hmm. It's amazing to talk on the faculty side of this, of how many people don't really know how to reach out to these communities. And you have the practitioner side who don't know how to get engaged with their academic partners that are right there in their neighborhoods. And so one of the project goals for the Center for Urban Innovation is to help programs across the country really engage their practitioner community, because that practitioner community needs them. And many of them don't understand that they have this amazing reservoir of intellectual capital right there in their community, and embodied by the faculty of their local universities. And North Carolina is blessed with a huge network of really top-notch schools across the state. Arizona, we have three universities, three public universities, and so it's a much smaller array of schools that people can tap into, which is one of the reasons why we try to reach out to those smaller communities that are further afield than just the Phoenix area, in order to help provide some of that that resource capacity for them.
I think there's two questions, and I don't know which one goes in which order, so I'll ask both. One is, how can faculty actually do a better job of connecting with those communities? But then also, how can faculty do a better job of making communities aware that they exist? So I'm thinking of, if you were trying to do a project here in North Carolina, you start Googling faculty, you don't know what the faculty are, you don't know who they are, what they do. So how would you make it so somebody could find you to be able to go help them out?
That's one of the things that we're working on, is literally a how-to for MPA programs to make themselves known to local governments through their leagues their leagues of cities. That's hard to say, as well as their ICMA chapters, if they have those. So really trying to use the existing networks to let those disseminate the information about faculty, and those programs then highlighting the work that faculty are doing that could lend themselves to needs across these states. So you think of the Benson example there, that's one of the things that speaks directly to me because of my interest in economic development. And I've worked a lot with communities that are pursuing sports as their silver bullet solution. And so I spent a lot of time trying to talk communities out of that investment because, again, much like a microbrewery, it's not going to have the kind of economic impact that's going to change the trajectory of a local economy. It's just too small potatoes. And that's, not what healthy economic development is really geared around. So there's a lot of that outreach that if we could match the talent that we have in our universities with the needs that are out there in our communities. It's just a mismatch that exists out there. So we're trying to figure out ways that will allow the schools to really do that, because you do have to know, if you're from the outside and you're trying to figure out, well, where is someone who can help me? And then you hit that university website and you're trying to figure out, well, what school, what department is this kind of person likely to be housed in, because they're not familiar with the siloed approach that many universities have. And somebody who, if they're looking for somebody doing community engagement and a particular university has a stellar individual in that area, that person could be in community psychology. And so if you're looking in public affairs, you may miss that person. So having right. universities bring together across their own silos an array of those kinds of specialists who deal with issues that cities face and communities face, I think would be an important first step. Somebody's got to do it, though. So at each university has to build this list, keep it relatively fresh, because that list is going to be far more useful than telling somebody, well, go to the go to the website of the university and try and find that person by topic. It's much more difficult to track people down that way than it is if we just provided them a list where you could go in by the need that you have and looking for community specialists than trying to go in and hunt across an array of different departments. So we're trying to work up a solution, and literally a how-to manual of how schools could prepare these documents that would help them reach out to their leagues, reach out to their chapters, who could then disseminate that information to the communities. We're also talking about utilization of capstones, utilization of internships, all those sorts of opportunities that would increase the engagement of the practitioner community with our PA-related programs, even though it's beyond just PA. That's obviously our primary focus given where we are.
That's a massive undertaking for a book.
Well, it's in pieces. So again, if we're trying, if you put it into a book, that's going to be an immediate turnoff to a lot of practitioners. That's just not the primary means by which they're going to absorb that kind of information. It would be great for me as an academic, doing a book like that. But in terms of actually, that's a bit of a difference. This is going back to an earlier question you had about trying to get faculty to do this kind of work is really tough, because we have an incentive structure not to do this kind of work, because this kind of work takes time and doesn't always lead to peer-reviewed journal articles, which is the coin of the realm for us in academia, right? So the coin of the realm, these journal articles that, again, represent fantastic work by these amazing intellectuals, but is unavailable to most of our public officials because they're behind paywalls. This is a challenge that a lot of journals have helped create just because of their own financial incentive structures. But then think about what universities have created with their P&T processes that do not value or fail to measure impact of the kinds that we would like individuals to have. If we had a better metric for capturing the impact of somebody writing a white paper or some kind of decision tool that gets downloaded by 10,000 local government administrators, that's a hell of a bigger impact than an article that's in a high-ranked journal that's going to be cited by a handful of other academics. So right. we fail to capture a measure of impact. And there's some scholars in our field that are trying to do some work on that, trying to change this culture, because you're changing the rules of P&T, but you have a first mover problem when you do that, because if you want faculty to engage in communities like this and get to be valued for this impact at the same time that you are wanting them to publish, then if that individual faculty member sees that the market as a whole doesn't value the community impact, then they're going to focus on the publication. So who moves first is a real challenge, and unless we get a cadre of prominent schools to do it together at the same time, which we're working on, that's a bit of a challenge.
Oh, yeah.
Changing culture is always a challenge.
So in, fall of 2013... fall of 2014, man, it's been a few years. Started working with the Midwest Public Affairs Conference when we initially launched it as a conference. And one of the things we did was we created the Journal of Public and Nonprofit Affairs, which you know, everything's supposed to have some type of applied nature behind it. Still peer-reviewed research, but it was supposed to, and it still is, it's open access. So anybody can you know, read it. And the GFOA would send out announcements to their membership whenever a new issue would come out. And it was great. But the problem we were having is getting faculty willing to write stuff and send stuff to us.
Exactly.
In part because the idea that it was open access automatically meant bad quality, which definitely wasn't the case. And, you know, the journal has published some great stuff, but you know, how do you even overcome that? Much less how do you overcome this? Bigger issue.
That's exactly. You're talking about that, the change in the culture, the perception of these, the fact that we're using citation metrics and the way that we measure our productivity as faculty is geared in such a way that it actually de-incentivizes the kind of work that I'm talking about in community and community impact, because that takes away from publications. And then you get into the issue of, okay, well, which publications? Because if we do work for that journal or you know others that are not ranked officially in citation indices, then who's going to want to publish in those? Those that are more likely to be open access, even peer-reviewed open access. You're right. There's a bit of a prejudice, if you will, about publishing in those outlets, which schools that you know faculty who are sitting on P&T committees and reviewing packets see that and somehow in their minds, either consciously or subconsciously, devalue that outlet. And we've got to, even though that article may have been downloaded, you know, so many times, practitioners aren't going to cite the work. So citation counts aren't the coin of the realm in that regard, but the downloads would be perhaps one other, perhaps even better metric for trying to capture the impact that particular article has. And again, there is no one answer to this because it's changing a culture, and this is really going to mean changing the incentive structures within institutions, which always takes time. But understanding what those institutional incentives are is an important first step, and that's kind of where we are now. Then we have to wrestle with the question, okay, well, how do we measure this impact if we're not talking about impact factors of the journals? If we're talking about impact in a broader sense of, you know, what's the value of you, Bruce, meeting with the city council in Raleigh and them implementing some really cool policy that you've come up with? That to me is real impact, probably more important than some of the journal articles that you've written. And this is not a slam on your journal articles. It's just in terms of the impact that it has on people's lives, that kind of work, it seems that we should do better, not calling it service, because service gets also that prejudicial judgment in many of our P&T committees, but rather service that has an impact in the community based on the intellectual training and the rigor that we bring to our work that can then be translated into actionable policy. It's pie in the sky. I've been you know plowing these fields for 20 years now. It's a very slow process, but it's my windmill and I'm tilting towards it.
One of my students will inevitably make fun of me for saying this because I've said it a number of times on previous recordings. There was a study a few years ago done by the Smithsonian. It took me a minute to remember the name of who did the study. The study done by the Smithsonian that looked at the frequency in which papers are read, not even how often they're cited. And the average paper that's published within academia in the United States gets read a grand total of 0 times published. So we do have this massive incentive, publish, you have to publish, you have to publish. But what good is it if nobody actually reads them anyway?
Exactly. No, you're nailing on the head. That is exactly the problem. We've created an industry through our incentive structure, through our P&T processes that extols more and more of these publications that have less and less impact. And think of this from the macro perspective. Those of us who are working at public institutions and we're doing this really cool research that could have great implications for our communities. we are working at public institutions who are facing significant cutbacks in the level of public investment in our institutions by our state legislatures, because our legislators come to us and they say, well, why aren't you teaching more? And we say, well, because I'm doing all this great research, so I have a lighter teaching load. So what great research is it to which you're referring? Well, all these journal articles that I've read, can I read them? No, they're behind a paywall, and you wouldn't really understand them because they're written in a language that is really aimed at other academics. That is not a way to endear us to our legislatures in terms of showing the return on the investment that they are making for the taxpayers in us. Our impact is going to be far greater in the eyes of legislatures if we can show that people are actually reading the work that we do. People, and by it's not just how many people, it's who is reading it. Can we demonstrate that our tools that we're creating, our recommendations, are actually getting discussed in city councils, in state legislatures, in Congress, where the stakeholders are actually considering and learning from the value of our intellectual contributions? That's where I think the impact really needs to be captured better, and not as part of service, as this kind of third leg that of the packet that people kind of don't give as much weight or credence to, but rather substantively the core of what it is that we do, because this represents not just the intellectual talent that we've been able to amass as an individual, but rather how can we share that talent with the communities that have invested in us, and the training that we've had and providing us the opportunities to really sink into these gnarly problems so that we can help communities wrestle with these wicked problems in order to advance the quality of life for citizens in multiple places. And maybe even, you know, help spread the diffusion of these new policy ideas that we might have and help them adapt to different kinds of communities facing different kinds of contextual situations. That requires a sensitivity not just to high-end statistical analysis or theory, but also an understanding of the real world. You know, how does this actually impact the lives of real people? How are they going to respond to a change in incentive structures in their community when it comes to healthcare or homelessness? Those are real challenges. So you can have a brilliant policy idea and put it out there for the community in the form of a freely available white paper. But if, again, that idea is not grounded in the real world, if you will, then what use is it to the community? Because you haven't taken into account the incentives to which people are responding, and your idea may be completely fantastical to them given the situation that they're confronting. So it is a very tricky cultural evolution to think about within our own institutions to incentivize more of that community impact side of what we as professionals can do. But the better we do that, the better we can articulate, the better we can measure and share the impacts that we're having, the better we'll be able to respond to state legislatures who are continuing to question the taxpayers' investment in higher ed.
I'm trying to think of a politically correct way of saying this.
We are in dangerous waters.
This is true.
Legislatures will not be listening to this podcast, though.
This is a very, very good point. But it really is a matter of, you know, they're the ones who write the budgets that the universities operate on. If they don't understand what we do, why would they fund us?
Yeah. Well, I mentioned before, yeah, I was very fortunate to be trained at IU in the workshop there with the Ostroms. And that way of thinking, this institutional design thinking is just permeates the way that I approach a problem like this. So you've got the individual incentives that we respond to as faculty in our P&T processes, but you also have to think about the higher level of incentives to which universities need to be able to respond if, in fact, they want to continue their historic role as crucibles within which new ideas are going to emerge in the context, in the course of providing training to the next generation of scholars, the next generation of public officials, the next generation of citizens. That's a pretty tall order, but I believe that you really do need to understand those incentive structures at these different levels in order to think through why tinkering with the incentive structures at one level is going to be important for addressing issues that have emerged at other levels, such as the state legislature.
Right. Playing devil's advocate for a little bit, in the absence or in the difficulty that it's going to be to change those incentive levels because they are so kind of ingrained in how we think on a professional academic standpoint, you have kind of said, well, screw the incentives. I'm going to do the work anyway.
I am not,
one of the reasons we get along.
Yeah, I may not be the person you want to emulate.
Well, but you've made the choice. So yeah. Despite the fact that you might not be the person people should emulate, why did you make the choice? And thinking back where you are now, would you still make the same choice if you had to remake it?
I made the choice early in my career. I started as an assistant professor at Rice State University in Dayton, Ohio. Then I got a position at Clemson University. And I raced to promotion and tenure very quickly. I cranked in a lot of articles, did my duty, and got tenure promotion early. But I had, even at that point in my career, I knew what I wanted to do. And I knew that I wanted to have the tenure protection to do the policy work that I've done over the course of my career and work in the applied field, knowing that that work is probably not going to have the same value to all institutions that I might think it should, but rather I wanted to make sure I was having an impact on different communities. And I've been very blessed with a great deal of personal satisfaction when I see a stadium get built that is financed through a rational financing arrangement that I helped put together. That's pretty exciting. When we put in place a decision tool that local governments utilize to help decide whether or not they're going to provide services in a collaborative fashion with another local jurisdiction, but they're using our tool, that's incredibly satisfying. Those are things I will never get credit for in a P&T review or any kind of academic annual review. That's just not how things operate right now in the traditional P&T process or annual review process. So that is a decision, and individuals have to make that decision with regards to the value of that. But let me tell you why I made mine, because it's not as irrational as it might appear. The audiences with whom I work in the community, nonprofit organizations, and local government, even state government, people don't ask me if I'm an assistant, an associate, or a full professor. That distinction only exists in academia. And for us, the value of the promotion to full professor is, okay, you get a little pay bump. That's nice, but it is usually a fairly small pay bump. And besides that, you end up getting to do a bunch more university level work, committee work. And I don't mean that disparagingly. We need right. that kind of faculty participation on our governance. I'm not trying to disparage that. But what I wanted to do, what I feel incentivized to do, is to work with communities out there and them take me seriously as an expert in the fields that I can address. And they don't care about the fact that I'm an associate as opposed to a full professor. That was a decision, a tactical decision I made many years ago that may not be what my colleagues in my institution wished I had done or continue to do, but rather that is really aimed at the communities that I want to serve. The value of the kinds of work that I do, I derive more so than a little pay bump and more committee service work. That's just me. And the tenure protection was more the important thing because I wanted to be able to, play a role in speaking truth to power. And tenure is extraordinarily important for us in academia to be able to do that. The problem is that we've kind of drifted away from that over the last several decades as an institution. I mean, not ASU, but I mean, the institution of higher education in America. We've drifted away from that role of tenure because we cower before power now and do not engage, even though we have those protections. And at the same time, we're allowing state legislatures to not only chip away at budgets, but also chip away at those protections, which means it's only going to be more and more difficult for us to speak that truth to power as we wrestle with very tough policy issues. I mean, there's no such thing as a simple policy issue, right? So how do we engage existing stakeholders that are benefiting from the status quo with potential change to that status quo that hopefully will benefit even more people? Hopefully some Pareto optimality can be achieved as opposed to some kind of zero-sum approach that we can do. But we're going to have to be able to have that conversation with the stakeholders, and tenure is really important for that. So the associate level for me has been the sweet spot, even though that does come with costs in terms of opportunities that may be harder to achieve within the institution that you work in. But the work that I do is so outward focused that I think I'm comfortable with the decision that I made because of the work that I get to do with the communities, with the civic leaders around the country, and the work, how they have internalized the work that I do for them is incredibly rewarding. And I see a much bigger impact from that than, generating another article in an academic journal. So that's just me, and I'm not casting aspersions on anybody else who does the traditional route, because that traditional route is the rational route for people on this path, given the incentive structures we've allowed to evolve. My argument is that we need to revisit those incentive structures if we're trying to protect the public investment in higher education and justify why it is that the taxpayer should subsidize our pet research projects.
Let's say that you were talking with somebody who's a junior faculty member in a department and they were doing this type of engage work.
I would tell the junior faculty member, do not do this. The junior faculty member needs to get tenure and must play the game. And I've had that conversation many times with colleagues over the years, is you need to get the journal articles out. Play the game, do your 5 years, go up for review, get tenure and associate. Then you can make the decision as to whether or not you want to continue on that pathway, which, again, nothing's wrong with that. Being a great teacher and a great researcher is perfectly fine. We don't want to get rid of that pathway. We want to add another pathway. And this other pathway then is, do you want to be able to go out there and chase contract dollars in order to do applied research that's going to create a solution to this problem that can then be acted upon by that private sector interest, by that public sector interest, that nonprofit sector interest? That's that conversation. It's a very good point. Is this is not something for junior faculty to be doing, because they're not going to get the credit that they probably deserve, but is not going to end up in a journal.
Yeah, I'm trying to think of how you would approach your chair and approach your department, and you shouldn't have to convince them to give you tenure. Your committee, your department should want to give it to you. If you have to convince them.
Yeah, if you're having to convince them in year five, some conversations should probably have already been had by that point. But you're right. This idea that the default decision should be that tenure is justifiable, that's just not how we've evolved. Over the last several decades, it truly has evolved quite a bit. And you see there are some research that's been done, some pieces in the Chronicle of Higher Education and all that about this evolution. I'm not just one voice in the wilderness here, but that has implications, and I'm far more interested in the implications of those changes as they've evolved, while we have continued to ratchet up the expectations for promotion and tenure. Not just here, but in institutions across the country, as we compete for those federal dollars, as we compete for contract dollars, you get some incentives that can be somewhat perverse to the mission of what a public institution is supposed to be about.
I'm thinking, I had a conversation within my department. We were talking about what it means to be an exceptional, not just a good researcher. And someone said, well, it needs to be about getting grant dollars that's specific to what you research. And I was like, well, I research governments going into financial decline. I was like, they don't have grand dollars to give me.
That's one thing that when you think about the humanities, broadly speaking, it's a lot harder to hustle contract dollars in the humanities field. So again, we have to tailor our incentive structures to our field. And in our field, there's a bit more opportunity to find financing for these kinds of activities. So you may not find a whole lot of federal support to you know, NSF is not probably going to be generating a lot of programs that you can compete for to do the kind of work you want to do. And it may be that there are other, maybe foundation dollars or something that's going to be more appealing, but those aren't federal dollars. Those don't count as much. It's like, but dollars are dollars, right? Exactly. Again, the incentives of the institution draw us to specific, in this case, funding sources, which, you know, somehow devalue a contract versus a grant. And grant dollars can be devalued between foundation philanthropic dollars versus non-federal public dollars versus federal public dollars. This is these are all incentives that have evolved like barnacles on the bottom of a boat. You know, they've just kind of glommed on over time as we've allowed this evolution to occur without really thinking about the implications for how the individuals playing the game, the faculty, are responding to those incentives. So it's not that there's any bad guy out there making some nefarious plan. There's no conspiracy theory. It's just this is how it's evolved. And it may be worth revisiting whether or not we would like to or should consider alternatives beyond just journal articles, just federal dollars, because, you know, I can support a PhD student on philanthropic money probably easier than I can on federal money. But the university wants the federal dollars. It's what they have to respond to in their competitive metrics. So it is not a simple change that we're talking about. It is a fundamental change in the incentive structures that higher education has to respond to. And at the same time, I'm really interested in helping this neighborhood organization, you know, take over control of pothole repair. It's really small scale stuff, but you know, at the macro level, it represents a fundamental change that would be required to reward the kind of work that applied researchers do. That's just the reality of the situation we fall into. And you're right, you know, junior faculty, they need to play the game in the short term in order to get to the point where they can make that decision. And then, of course, maybe one day they don't have to make that decision. They'll be rewarded no matter which path they're on.
One of the things we were talking about before we were recording, or I guess it might have been while we were recording, was there's not really that many people in PA that really do this kind of work. You know, if you're a PhD student who's actually interested in going into the applied side of things, if you are an assistant and you're still kind of interested in it, you know, even though you're encouraging them to wait until after tenure just to kind of start engaging in it, what would be kind of the first step? You know, you now have tenure, you want to go out, what would be the first thing you would tell them?
Well, you know, what I do with my PhD students, and this kind of drives them nuts sometimes, is they'll write some really great theoretical pieces or have some really good policy idea that they've generated, grounded in the literature and all this. And my first response, 90% of the time, my first response is going to be, so what? Okay, this is great. What you've done is fantastic. And I, as a methodologist, I really love the statistical approach that you've identified here. But what does this mean? How does a community act on this? How does a stakeholder take this statistically significant parameter and do something with it? So I do force them, often against their will, because many of them are very introverted, to go out and actually engage with these folks. Now, they're not going out to the extent that I do, the kind of work that I do as director of the center, but they're going out there to interview, for instance, a city manager, to understand the marketplace, if you will, of where their idea would find some kind of purchase. Not what we typically teach in PhD programs, but it was exactly the kind of training that I got. And, you know, from some fairly successful scholars themselves, and I think I've done a fairly decent job of doing that kind of applied work myself, not because it's going to help them race to promotion and tenure immediately, but rather that as they continue to do that, as PhD students and as junior faculty, keeping a finger on the pulse of what's happening outside the office to I think is useful so that they are in a much better position after tenure and promotion to make the decision of which path they want to go down at that point. Do they want to do more applied research? Do they want to focus more heavily on journal articles? Without having had some experience reaching out like that, without knowing some of these practitioners that are out there, these nonprofit CEOs that are out there, these individuals that are serving in our state legislatures, our city councils, there's no basis upon which they could make a different decision than to stay on the research path, right? They need some kind of access to that real world, if you will. I keep coming back to that. It's an oversimplification, but I think you know what I mean. This real world outside of academia that they can understand how their work can help them, as opposed to just being a journal article that's going to be cited, say, 10 times over the next 10 years in a journal that's ranked at whatever level it's ranked. So that is it's a fundamentally different way of thinking about how we should measure ourselves. But the junior up and coming faculty, I think it's really important for them to understand, to start developing that understanding, so that when they are in a position to consider alternative pathways, they have enough information on which to decide whether or not hustling contracts with local governments in order to do small projects but that solve very specific problems, that's actually pretty cool. Now, if you're not out there talking and working with these organizations normally, on what basis would you ever choose to do that? It just does not make economic sense from an individual perspective, given the existing incentive structures that we face in our universities.
That's definitely a good point. If you don't have the experience, if you don't even haven't sat there, met with anybody, haven't really thought too much about how, you know, your work is going to be applied or what people need from the community, by the time you come around and say, well, I'm going to start doing this, people are going to start going, well, you've been here for 5, 6, 7 years. Why haven't you done it before?
Yeah.
And that might create skepticism.
Some skepticism, it's also, there's also value, even if you stay on the research intensive path, if you will, and your journal article is going to be your bread and butter, I would still make the argument that engaging outside of the classroom, this is kind of the I-Corps model, the innovation core model that the National Science Foundation supports, getting out of the building and talking to the people who would be affected by the kind of research that you're doing, whether they're city managers, whether they're department heads, whether they're citizens on the street, whether, you know, whomever your policy idea, your research touches, ask them, what is it that they confront on a daily basis to understand their situation, to see how your ideas fit. I think that it was a really good way of bringing some very low-level qualitative information, if you will, to bring to life our more quantitative models. And of course, people who are doing qualitative analysis frequently are engaging with people out in the field in order to gain the data that they need to do their analyses. But for those of us who are really, more on the numbers jockeys, if you will, it's really important to, I think, have those kinds of experiences outside of the classroom to understand that our models are based on a whole set of assumptions. Wouldn't you be better served by testing some of those assumptions, by having a few conversations with people out in the real world? So that's what my career has been about, is testing those assumptions.
Well, I think that's actually a pretty good way to end our conversation.
Okay, well, it's been a pleasure.
Well, thank you for coming on.
No problem. Anytime.